minutes, 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff. 32 minutes past the hour. Tower cleared.
Here, we got a roll program.
And as Apollo 11 does its roll program, this podcast now does its roll program. The tape is rolling. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. Thank you for taking time from your life to be here. This is episode 2, Act 1, Scene 1. The question is, where does the intelligence behind the UFO phenomena come from? And number 2, how did they get here? I'll leave the first question for a later broadcast, or at least my guess as to where they come from. Today in episode 2, I want to talk about one of the theories about how they may get here. And this has to do with portals. I've done a lot of research on this subject over the years, and I got involved in a number of years ago on what are called Zendras. Now, Zendras is a term used by a group that started in Peru that has expanded around the world to maybe 25,000 people. And it was called at that time Mission Rama. A lot of the people who practice it don't really refer to themselves as Mission Rama people. But the protocols that they use are like CE5 protocols, which were invented in 1974 when Sixto Paswell and his brother Charlie had an encounter through automatic writing of a craft that an entity that claimed to be extraterrestrial. Over the years, they developed these protocols, and over the years, they have been able to, from time to time, have an interaction with the intelligence. They use a series of messages that they get through what they call antennas. They will usually require two people in a group that will get a message, usually through automatic writing. And when the two messages agree, they will know where to go and when to go. They can be very accurate down to the minute and to the exact location where a craft will appear. From time to time over the years, and this doesn't happen all that often, but from time to time, a portal, or what they call a Zendra, will open. I've done a number of investigations and interviews and YouTube videos on two that occurred at Mount Shasta, California, 2014-2015. In August of 2020, there was another Zendra that opened, and we are at the moment doing an investigation into that, and it will undoubtedly be the most paranormal story I have ever run across in my 46 years of experience. What I want to do today is go back, and I've got a number of people that have testified on this, and almost all these people are Latino, which is one thing that's very common in the phenomena. The other thing that's very common is there are no evil aliens. I defy anybody to go into the Mission Rama literature and find greys, reptilians, evil aliens. They're all basically beings that are benevolent, blondes, this sort of thing, almost like the 1950s. The interview I'm going to play today is an interview that was set up for me by Joe Burks, who was one of the original coordinators with the Disclosure Project in the 1990s in California. And the interview we're going to play today is an interview I did with Joe Vallejo. Now, Joe Vallejo was a pilot. He flew when he was flying United. He flew the big jumbo jets as a captain, so he's not exactly some guy that lives on the street. Very highly qualified in terms of what he's going to say. The interview that you're going to hear is an interview I did with him in which I talk about two different things. The one thing I talk about, and I will do this in another broadcast, and that is people that have flown the craft. That's another thing that I've done extensive work on. I have 50 people who claim that they have been allowed to fly the flying saucer, the UFO, whatever you want to call it. I have said that every one of them says exactly the same thing. So in this interview, you'll hear Joe Vallejo, a captain on United Airlines, talking about his experience of flying the craft. He describes it as a dream, which all people describe it as a dream. But the thing that I wanted to play today, because we're in this investigation onto the 2020 Zendra that opened at Mount Shasta, is his experience in a Zendra. This occurred many years ago in California, and he will describe the group. And I've actually got in the show notes, I will give a link to an article done by Joe Burks that explains a little bit clearer this group and Joe Vallejo's association with this group. This portal was opened, this Zendra was opened a number of years ago, a couple of decades ago. There was 49 people went through it. Joe was one of the last people to go through it. You'll hear him describe the experience, how he got involved with the group, and it does indicate almost something that is akin to what Kit Green was reported to have said, according to Jim Peniston from the Rendlesham Forest. He had been told that the defense group that Kit Green was working for, working with experiencers, were trying to figure out how does the phenomena pop in and pop out just as quickly. That's the whole idea behind portals. They are coming in, they are popping in, and they are popping out through these sort of interdimensional gateways, whatever you want to call them. So here's the interview with Joe Vallejo. It's a little bit of a long interview, but it's very, very interesting from a highly qualified listener.
Central Intelligence Agency, Joseph Vallejo, case officer. May I help you?
Joe Vallejo, it's Grant Cameron phoning. I was talking to Joe Burks about talking to you.
Yes, who is this?
It's Grant Cameron. I'm phoning from Canada.
Grant Cameron. Oh, Grant, yes.
Yes.
I thought it was a friend of mine calling.
Oh.
And he usually pulls the no caller ID.
Oh, yeah.
So I pulled that stunt on him.
Yeah, I was wondering who I was talking to there for a second. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I'm phoning off Skype because I really don't have I've got a cell phone, but I don't really have a long distance plan. So I usually use Skype to make all my long distance phone calls.
Oh. I understand. Where are you located right now, Grant?
Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Never been there.
Yeah. So it's...
Good that you called.
Yeah, it's an honor to talk to you.
Joe this morning.
Yeah, it's an honor.
My pleasure.
Yeah. I had talked to Joe quite a few times over the years, and it appears you have two stories that I've been fascinated with. One is the story of the Zendras, and I got involved with the Mission Rama last year. Didn't want to get involved. Had a bizarre, I don't know if you know the story, I got a bizarre connection to them. Got sort of dragged in and sort of came across this story of the Zendras where 2014, 2015, a series of people went through at Mount Shasta. I interviewed a number of these people on tape, and I thought this is, in 43 years of researching, this is the best sort of stories I've ever heard in terms of the number of witnesses and the credibility of these witnesses. And that's the one story I heard that you had an experience. And the other was one that I've just started to make public. I first ran up across a woman in 2013 who told me she was flying the craft, and I thought she was totally crazy. And I've now got about 48 people who have usually described as a dream experience of flying a craft or a UFO, and that includes mostly a lot of women, but I do have one U.S. Air Force retired colonel F-16 pilot who just about a month ago told me the story in Los Angeles. And I'm fascinated with it because everybody tells basically the same story. And I'm not sure whether you're familiar with the Free Foundation. Their stats of the 4,000 experiencers show that I think it's 14% of all experiencers claim they've flown the craft. And I'm still trying to convince them to do something with this data that I think is pretty significant. But that's why I was interested in talking to you, is because I believe you've got a story that deals with both of these things that just fascinate me.
Right. The one about flying the craft, you know, I tend to forget a lot of these things and kind of bury them for some reason. I've known Joe for like maybe 40 years and I trust him. You know, he's a very decent guy, and we have been through, you know, different adventures together.
Yeah.
So we are like brothers, you know.
Yeah.
And I trust him 100%. And when I was a 737 captain, you know, you go through the progression of different equipment.
Yeah.
And my first captain seat was in the 737, so I was mostly flying domestic routes and some Central American routes.
Yeah.
You know, then I went to the 57, the 67, and I finished the 47-400. But I remember the second time I was in Seattle on a layover, and I called Joe and I said, "Hey, Joe, I had a dream. This is what happened, blah, 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 blah." And so Joe said, "Don't you remember about a year ago you called me and you said that you had a dream that's quite similar to the one you're relating to me now?"
Wow.
And I said, "I don't remember that." And so this time around, I said, "Joe," I said to myself, "you're going to remember this." And I do remember. I was at the hotel. It was the day after, you know, I spent a night there in Seattle. And so I had just gotten up. I remember the dream. I called Joe, you know, and that second day I was going to go somewhere else, but I don't remember where I was supposed to go or to fly to. But I called Joe, and that's when Joe said to me, "Yes, you told me of a similar dream about a year ago, roughly more or less."
Yeah.
I said, "Oh boy, you know, really?" And basically what it was is there was a very large, I couldn't see very much detail around me other than there was a gigantic screen, almost a wall-like situation where I was actually standing. I had my hands on something that I could not see. It was like a flat, round surface or something of that nature.
Yeah.
And there was another person standing next to me. And I was looking at this gigantic screen, and we were going through some clouds. You know, coming out the other side of the clouds. And I was the person who was actually controlling this craft. But it was the situation that what I get, it was that the physical touching was more like some sort of a connection. It was an entrainment. It was more of a connection to the brain, to my brain. And it was all mostly controlled by thought, something, later on, they came out with this movie called Firefox with,
Clint Eastwood.
Yes.
Yeah.
where there was some kind of a mental, unlike in the movie where he actually has to think, and I'm sure they did that for the benefit of the movie, where he vocalizes. There was no vocalization. It was just mind and craft. It was, rather than the craft controlling the person controls the craft, sort of a augmentation or an extension of the person's brain functioning.
Right.
And that's all really what I remember. And I don't know, I have not told anybody else, I have not compared notes with anybody. I don't know how my situation compares with the other guys or anything. This is basically, in a nutshell, what I experienced.
You're describing, minus a couple details, exactly what people are describing. You put your hand on a panel, a ball. Did you get a sense that the only thing you didn't describe is people will give the description that the craft is sort of alive? Did you become one with the craft?
Yes. You are, it's an entrainment where the two of you connect. It's a common venue or communication means I was more like a very, perhaps an oversized bowling ball type thing. It wasn't flat. It was kind of round.
Yeah.
But I did not see this. I can tell you by the way it felt in my hands that there was a curvature to it.
Yeah.
But I could not see how the size of it.
Fascinating. Yeah. I've got a YouTube channel called White House UFO. I've started to put people up there. I've got, in fact, the latest one I just put up there was a girl who was out of Boulder, Colorado, a singer who actually opened for Pat Boone when she was very, very young. She describes exactly what you're describing, the ball, the sort of the interacting, the sort of the mind connection. And she describes it. She kept saying, well, you know, it was sort of a dream. And I said, same as the guy who was the F-16 pilot. He said, well, it was just a dream. And I said, well, everybody says it's just a dream, but everybody's describing the same thing. And so very fascinating, this.
Oh, wow.
And I think the military may, that's the whole thing, the symbiotic relationship. If you get a fighter pilot who can, you know, fire weapons and fly without having to really think about, you know, sort of just, it goes where you want it to go. I think that makes sense that they probably already have, like with the Firefox thing, they may already have some of this technology, and that's where they're headed with this.
Right.
It's a symbiotic relationship. So basically you have described what everybody else described it. And I think, it, you know, if I tell people that, you know, I've mentioned you to a couple people, it sort of gives people sort of verification, because if you hear a girl who's a singer talk about it, or this other woman really was just, you know, just a woman that really didn't have any sort of background. But when people start hearing fighter pilots and people who've flown airliners, you know, that they've had the same thing, then it sort of, everybody goes like, well, maybe there's something to this. Maybe people are actually describing this. Maybe this is actually going on. And it leads to the question, why would they allow us to fly the craft? It sort of indicates, you know, especially the evil alien thing. I always say, you know, if you believe there's evil aliens, then you've got to realize that, you know, in Saudi Arabia until last year, it was illegal for a woman to drive a car. But if you're on board the ship, they'll let her fly the ship. No license, no insurance, nothing. And they seem to be, for whatever reason, training people to levitate, to fly crafts, this sort of thing. And it's this important concept that you probably already know, because you've done a lot of CE5 work, is this whole idea that consciousness may be the basis of what's actually going on here. It may be the key component.
Exactly.
that everybody's leaving out. People want to do the nuts and bolts. Let's pull a little free energy engine out, and you know we can drive our SUV for free and stuff like that. And when you get to the CE5, and what I'm realizing from both the flying of the craft and the Zendra thing, you're starting to look at consciousness, and this thing is going to be much less physical than people think it is. It's much more to do with consciousness being the sort of the ground of being.
Right. And you know, there is no, it's like a total complete surrender. There is no if and buts. You're one. There is a sense of calmness. There is no sense of any threat. It is 100% connection.
Wow. Fascinating. Yeah. Well, I appreciate you telling me that. Now, can you tell me the story of the, I'll give you a little bit of background on my experience with Mission Rama. I was going there, they were doing a meditation for world peace on the mountain, and I have a friend who helped me edit some books and stuff out of L.A. who originally was from Colombia, and she wanted me to go there and meditate, and it was like, you know, I got nothing against meditation, nothing against world peace, but I'm a long way away. I'm a 40-hour drive from Mount Shasta, and I'm thinking, well, do I really want to go sit on a mountain? And as I'm going there, she had supported me, did stuff, editing and stuff, so I figured, I'll go with her, I'll support her, I'll go up and we'll do some meditation on the side of this mountain. So as I'm traveling across the country, there's a girl with me, and she gets a message on her cell phone. And it's from Antarel, the being from planet Apu, and it's an indirect message from somebody else and says, Antarel knows you're coming to, Grant's coming to the mountain. There's going to be a program sighting on Saturday night. And so on Saturday night, they have these antennas, which just, these people fascinate me. There's two antennas. One was a PhD trained at Columbia University psychologist, and the message she got was 9:33, and that's exactly when this event happened over my head. It was just that, and I was like hooked. I could not believe, you know, that is like a CE5 is, you know, is one thing. This is almost like a CE5 on steroids, where you're picking it up to the minute when this thing's going to happen. And I was so fascinated, and that's when I came across this Zendra story and interviewed a whole series of witnesses who were at this event, who had been in these events in 2014 and 2015, and I became fascinated with the story. And then I was talking to Joe, and he mentioned you had been involved in one where there was 50 people. I have one in Uruguay with 125 people with this sort of interdimensional portal thing, and I found out these things are all over the world. So I'm basically trying to gather these stories, and was fascinated by the fact that you had been involved in one. And so I was interested if you could tell the experience and what happened inside it.
Right. I have a question. How much time do we have?
No, I'm free. Whatever time. It's up to you.
Okay. Because it's it could be somewhat lengthy to explain to you this whole process with me.
Oh, wow.
And so we have time, that's good.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Since I was very young, I was very lucky to know what I came to do. I was going to be a pilot.
Okay.
I was going to fly whatever it is that I could. And since a very early age, if you would talk to those people who were around that were older, most are deceased, of course, now, that you would see Joe flying his little toy airplane.
Yeah.
So that's what I came to do. And in my teenage years, I demonstrated interest in anything and everything that had to do with the sky, astronomy, all of that. It was innate knowledge to me that we could not possibly be the only entities that were conscient, alive in this universe.
Yeah.
That I took that as a granted, as a known situations very early in my life. I came to the United States when I was 16 years old.
Yeah.
And I had my private pilot's license by the time I was 21 years old. And, overcame my language limitations, the fact that I was political exile, having to work, having to get an education, having to pay for my own flight training, all of that. I overcame tremendous odds because I was driven by what I wanted to achieve. So My background is basically as a flight instructor. That's how I accumulated my experience. Got hired with United Airlines back in 1978. I had to go fly whatever I could, you know, everywhere. So I went to the Middle East, and I went to Central America, and I flew DC-3s, and I went through all of the situation where you acquire your experience in order to qualify for the airlines.
Yeah.
Now, and I was a 727 co-pilot. And we were flying, it was early in the morning, and we were flying between Los Angeles and Denver.
Okay.
It was clear, a visibility unlimited. It's what we call in aviation CAVU, CAVU, ceiling and visibility unlimited.
Okay.
Overseas, they call it CAVU K. And we were at 33,000. I was in the right seat as a co-pilot. And we were being given a vector to a radio station, navigational station. DVC is Dove Creek, is the name of the station in Colorado.
Okay.
You know, then again, we were going to Denver. And I looked off my right side, and about hour 2 o'clock, and there was a cylinder. It was self-luminous. It had no wings. It was cigar-shaped. And I looked at this thing, and I looked at my captain, and I said, have you seen this thing over at 2 o'clock? So he looks over there and says, no, I didn't notice it until now.
Well,
so the flight engineer looks at it. He also sees it. And then this cigar started to all of a sudden bounce up and down, and then it got back to steady flight. So I told the captain, you know, why don't we check for Wright's reports to see if anyone has experienced any turbulence, because he seems to be going through some turbulence, and we might have to turn on the seatbelt sign and precautionary in case we do hit the turbulence. You don't want anybody to get hurt. So I checked with radar control. So we have a traffic 2 o'clock, and he seems to be experiencing turbulence. Do you have any Wright's reports this morning? And the radar controller comes back to us and says, I do not see a radar return for any target at your 2 o'clock, nor should there be one there, because we don't have a flight plan for any other aircraft in your vicinity. And at that point, well, there it is. We called one of the flight attendants. She looks at it. She sees the thing. And it stayed with us for another 10, 15 minutes. And then what was strange is when they gave us a frequency change, I looked down, put the new frequency in the radio, and I was going to ask the next controller to see if he could see it on his radar screen.
Okay.
When I look to see the traffic, it had gone, disappeared. Never saw it leave. And so, pretty much, my subjective experience was that I saw this craft and had no wings. It was self-luminous. It was very bright. And I said to myself, well, maybe there goes somebody else like me, like myself, you know, from another world.
Okay.
But nevertheless, we do the same thing. That's what we do.
Yeah.
And that was one experience I had. So, you know, as everything in life, you look back and there are things that happen, and then they kind of dovetail into each other, events.
Okay.
And they make a meaningful whole. This thing with Joe started with Dr. Greer, and I met Joe in this group. And then we went to this event in Arizona, and we did by that time we had done several field work and had several minor experiences. I remember we sat in the desert, we meditated, these wild rabbits came out. And some of the people in the group started feeding them cookies. Wow. And I thought that was very strange to have these wild animals by your feet, which you know are very scary. They survive on fear.
Yeah.
And that's their only defense mechanism. There I met this gentleman who had a Italian last name, who is from Peru. So I know a little Italian, started speaking Italian to him, and he said, no, my parents are Italian, but I was born in Peru, so we switched to Spanish. And he gave me the name of this gentleman who is a dentist from Peru, and he had this group that met every Saturday. So gave me the phone number. I talked to this guy on the phone. He said, why don't you come up to San Francisco where we'll meet? And what happened then is, we set up a time and a date where he would come to the airport. He would pick me up, and I would then participate and meet these people. And, I was with my uniform, but the thing is, I thought, well, I'm going to be just a pilot. It's going to be very hard for him to pick me out of the group. So I had this jacket that was like a grape color. So I took off my coat, and put this jacket on. So, and I called him. I said, I'm wearing this, and you cannot miss me. It's a kind of a loud color. So anyways, he picked me up at the airport, took me to his house. I met some of the people in the group. I started attending these meetings on Saturdays. I would go to Burbank, jump on the airplane. I get picked up at the airport in San Francisco, attending his meetings. Then I would be driven back to the airport. I jump on the airplane and go back to Burbank. And then I used to live in, grew up in the San Fernando Valley, Ventura County area, Westlake Village.
Okay.
So anyways, the situation was that we started going to Shasta, and like the second time or so we went to Shasta, there was this woman visiting from Peru, and this man, who you should probably have heard about him, his name is Fernando.
Yeah.
Fernando passed out these tablets with pencils and said, any of you that gets any messages, I want you to write whatever it is down, whether it makes sense or not, it's not important. Just open up your minds and then let's see what comes in. And so I was given the tablet and the pencils just like everybody else, and I said, well, I don't. So, okay, let's see what. And what came in was that there was going to be an encounter with persons of another planet, basically. And I said, there are going to be seven people picked from groups like ours, from different parts of the world. But what I see is that this encounter is going to happen in a very tropical setting, like a jungle.
Wow.
So I guess it is not going to be in the United States, but that's all I know.
So you're getting automatic writing? Are you receiving the automatic writing?
It was not automatic writing. My hands did not write. It was more like a message.
Okay.
By the way, I am an individual who sometimes gets this. I get it in the shower, when I'm taking a shower.
Okay.
This is how I met Nancy, my girlfriend.
Okay.
I get these things where it's like a song that gets in your brain.
Yeah.
And you cannot get rid of it. You know, a thought form?
Yeah.
And And when I met Nancy, I was given specific instructions. Step one, step two, step three, step four. And at the time, I was separated. I lived like a hermit. I had very little contact with people. And that is how I was pulled out of my being a hermit into a relationship with this woman.
Okay.
That I am with today.
Okay.
And that's a totally different story. And I can tell you about that as well, but it would take us away from the what we're doing today.
Okay.
So I got this, and I told the group what I had gotten, and I said, this is a very far-fetched thing. I'm just telling you because I feel free to speak. Otherwise, I probably wouldn't even say it.
Yeah.
But as I provided more and more details, this woman from Peru that was visiting seemed to be smiling more and more and more. And then I caught a couple of, they were looking back and forth between Fernando and this lady. And I, later on, I thought, oh, there is something going on here. So after we had a break in the, with this meeting.
Okay.
And this was the middle of the night, Shasta, same location. I was by my car, and she came over to me and said, my name is such and such, I'm visiting from Peru. You know, I knew, of course. And I said, well, yeah, my name is, I'm originally from Cuba, and I'm kind of new at this. And, your first time in the United States, blah, 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 you know, making small talk. And then she says, you're not crazy, don't worry. She says something very strange. She says, you're one of the ancient ones. I can see by your eyes. And I said, oh, really? No kidding. You know, I thought it was. So I am the kind of a person that I shy away from ego. You know, I stay out of that. That is not my thing.
Yeah.
So turned out that later on I learned that the message that I had gotten, there was a guy in Uruguay, I think, and another guy in El Salvador that had gotten the same thing.
Wow.
And that these people use these so-called antennas.
Yeah.
And the way they did it is they did not divulge the information as not to contaminate the source.
Yeah.
And when they have the same message received by different people who do not know each other.
Exactly, yeah.
That is how they validate the messages.
Yeah, I'm aware of that, yeah.
Okay, so matter of fact, this guy Fernando was one of the ones that went to that situation in Peru. And so the next thing is, I get a bid as a captain in the 6-7 in Miami. You know, bigger up and more money, blah, 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 blah. Natural progressions of things. Because my parents retired. They lived in California. They went to live in Miami. You know, they went to the Cuban Mecca, Miami, Florida.
Yeah.
So I started flying out of Miami, and I ended up flying to Lima, Peru. And then I started to meet with groups down there. I went and visited this lady again, met her husband and all of that. Visited Peru, took my family, did the tourist stuff.
Yeah.
Had a few sightings, all of that. And then later on, I bid back to Los Angeles from Miami and started flying out of L.A. And so I stopped flying South America because in order to fly South America, you have to be based out of Miami, Florida.
Okay.
Started again attending those meetings, those outings on the weekend. and had several experiences. One of them was one time we were sitting this at the campground. We were this sitting around, and this light floated by, and very silent. You could not hear a cricket, and it split up into two, horizontally separation. And then it sat there for a few minutes, and then it got back to being one, and it floated away. And it was very low to the ground, maybe half a mile from us, and it went away.
Okay.
So the situation with the Sendra, we went out on an outing again, and there were maybe 50, 60, it was in August, it was the summer. And so we started to do a mantra, to, you know, out loud.
Yeah, yeah.
And this mantra is Zinuro. And this mantra is supposed to be the mantra that is used to open up these portals.
Oh, okay.
Yes. And you know, most people will hear that it was Om. Truth is that there is somewhat of a reticence in actually divulging the real mantra for that. I don't have a problem with it, because then again, we go back to the issue of consciousness. I believe that you can use the correct mantra, and I think that if your consciousness is not there, it isn't going to happen.
Right.
That is my opinion. I don't believe that the mantra is just an automatic door opener per se. I think there has to be other ingredients in the mix.
Okay.
But then again, I could be wrong. So we started doing that, and it took 2-3 hours at least.
Wow.
And I did not know what was going to happen, and yes, we did get the Sendra. Fernando was in the middle of a field, and you kind of had to look at it in a certain way. If you looked at it, you know, it's almost like when you look in the dark. If you look at it straight, it kind of, it disappears a little bit. But if you look at it sideways with your peripheral view, then you'd be able to see it.
Okay.
And this thing was maybe 12, 14 feet tall. There was a point of light, and then there were like light beams that were arched actually, and it was like a wigwam or a teepee, but the sides were curved.
Okay.
Perhaps like the window of a Gothic church, maybe.
Okay.
And the people, the members of the group went in and out, but they were allowed to go in according to their cosmic names.
Oh.
The finishing of the cosmic names. At that point, I did not have my cosmic name. You know, that comes in several different possible avenues of delivery.
Okay.
People sometimes get it in dreams. Sometimes there are designated persons who, during a meeting, will sort of, I hate to use the word channel, but they will be given the names, and then they tell you what your name is.
Yeah.
And this name is supposed to be like held at a personal level and not really communicated to people.
Yeah.
So I did not have my cosmic name. But according to the termination of the cosmic name, for example, there are a group whose termination is EL, like Antarel.
Okay.
He is an EL. His termination is EL. There are the AMs, like Adam. The first group of souls to incarnate on this plane were the Adams.
Okay.
You know, the Adamic race, the AM.
Okay.
And there is also the ACs, like Anitak. It's an AC.
Okay, yeah.
And so they grouped them together, and they went in and out of this Sendra. I did not have my name yet, so I did not know, so I was left towards the last group. And so when we went in, this thing had lost some of its strength and started to fade. So we had to pump up the volume, so to speak,
okay,
and recite the mantra to keep it alive.
Wow.
So I was being one of the last ones to go in there. I may not have experienced the full 100% effect of it, because it was, we had to, matter of fact, after we stepped out of it, then it started to really fade and it disappeared.
Wow.
And so, the situation with the Sendras are, there are different kinds of Sendras where, there are some where you step in and it's like a door, a portal, a gate to another reality.
Yeah.
Where you step out the other side and you're somewhere else. It's like a Stargate.
Yeah.
Or something like that. And so, you know, then again, I have this thing where I tend to forget sometimes this kinds of events. I don't know why, but that's pretty much. And I have to say that this situation where I came up with this meeting in the jungle, this and that, I never since then got another message that was the first and last.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did other people, what were people experiencing? They say the earlier people that went in, did they, because some people get messages and, or like the event in there, what were they describing?
As far as the Sendra experience?
Yeah, like the earlier people that went in, or the other people, did you talk to the other people after they've been through?
I think a lot of them were like, it's like, you're in awe of this experience. You're like, it's like, is this really happening? So we did not compare notes, or there were expressions of, wow, look at this. And I would think that if you experience it a second or third time, which I hear people have, you might be able to really get a better handle. What I recall is that the density, it was almost like being underwater. The density of the air was like almost like if you're diving in the sea where it was denser. However, you could breathe normally. There was no impact on your breathing.
Wow.
That's what I remember the most. And because we had to really work at the mantra to keep it alive, maybe that detracted from the experience.
Wow.
So I would say to you, if you can get somebody who went in there when this thing was at its full-blown effect,
yeah,
that would probably be a more, the level of fidelity of the information would be probably better than what I experienced, because we went in there and we had to work for it. So it perhaps detracted from the experience itself.
And these are Rama people that you're dealing with, like in terms of dealing with beings from Apu or whatever.
These are Rama people. Some of them have received their crystals, and some not. At the time, I had not received my crystals, and which I did later on, and so. But most of them, it's a funny thing. In the summer, being that it is August, a lot of tourists, what I call tourists, would show up, friends of those who were dedicated workers and all that. Unlike in the winter time when it was very cold and a lot of people did not go, or it was the rainy season and people would not go. But it was summertime. It was camping time. And families with children would come, and some of them didn't even know why the heck they were there. They were just there for the outing, in a sense.
Yeah. Were you actually on Mount Shasta, or were you near Shasta?
No, these other people's location is near Shasta.
Okay, that's right. Yeah, I understand.
It's not on the mountain.
Okay,
it is in Shasta County.
Yeah, that's what I understand. Okay, I just want to clarify that.
Correct. Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's...
And of course, they are protective of their location.
Sure, Oh, yeah. And do they still meet? Are these people still around, the group, the Rama people in San Francisco area?
I believe they are. I kind of disconnected, every group, and Joe will tell you this, that the person who started this, Sisto Paz Wells, kind of went off into a tangent, and we have had other people who have tried to fill in his shoes that also have gone into a tangent, and there has been like splitting different groups. That comes along with being a human, I suppose, but also comes along with the fact that apparently they seem to favor certain specific persons, and then they have a falling out, and it keeps repeating itself, and I don't know why this methodology keeps happening, because and this is one of my own questions, is why does it keep happening? Why do they pick a certain person and then that person goes off? In the case of Sixto, there were rumors of some monies involved, and then I will say this guy that I know, he doesn't touch any money. He doesn't get any money. Doesn't ask for any money, has nothing to do with money. In the case of Sixto, there were issues with money.
Yeah.
And that was part of the reason when I was flying into Lima, a lot of times I would get to the hotel and there would be a package for me, which was mostly a sleeping bag. With a message, if you want to go to this thing, call this guy, he'll pick you up. And I say, groovy. So rather than spend my 28 hours in Lima walking around, and I'd be out in the field with the Rama people. I'd be down in Chilca, for example. And I did meet Sixto, and I was there for one of his things down in Chilca. And he said, they're going to come in. I just got a message. They're going to be here at 3 o'clock in the morning, or they're going to be here. And nothing ever happened.
Wow. Interesting.
A lot of information that did not come to fruition.
Wow.
And so there has been disenchantments and separations and that kind of a thing.
Yeah. I know there's even, I've been involved in some of the politics as well. And I've only been involved with it in less than a year.
Right.
I guess the ego gets in there. People sort of start seeing themselves as the center of the whole story. And
yes. Yes, exactly. The ego. Then I know a guy who was from Argentina, and he would send Sixto money every month to support the mission, and then I think Sixto was just not working and living off of the money, and his wife had issues, had problems too.
Yeah.
He got stopped at the border when he was trying to enter, and they said they turned him back, and they said it was because of his work. Turns out that he had a large sum of money that he did not declare, and somehow they caught on to that, and I believe this is why he got in trouble, and things began to get murky. And so I've noticed there's been a couple of other guys. Another thing that I noticed with Rama is that a Sixto goes bye-bye, and other people will come up, try to fill in the shoes of Sixto.
Yeah.
And it's the same pattern. They want to be protagonists. I'll tell you about a certain individual. They went to Ecuador, and Ecuador, there is a very large cave system. There's, which I don't know how true this is, but there have been some writings about a series of subterranean caves that interconnect throughout South America.
Okay.
That were dug in by some ancient people, or I don't know very much about it. But there is a place in Ecuador called La Cueva de los Tallos. It's the cave of this type of bird that flies at night. It's not a bat, but it's about bat-like behavior.
Okay.
And they are supposedly going in there, and they're being these beings there. Well, nobody ever gets to see anything. But this particular guy, the guy who writes the books, he goes in there by himself, and he claims that he sees these people. So it is a question of being a protagonist, being by himself, and not having anyone around that can corroborate anything. And there's been two or three different individuals that have tried to do this. And if I were to give accolades to anybody, is this particular guy from the Bay, where the guy who runs these groups, he stays out of all that.
Yeah.
He has nothing to do with that. And that's why I kind of gravitated towards him in particular. Because he wasn't looking to make money, he wasn't looking to be known. I have revealed the information. I asked him, is it okay? And he said, let it all go, except the location. I said, I understand. And so now I'm talking, and pretty much that's... There is another person, and I don't know if Joe has steered you towards him. There's a young man here in L.A., by the name Enrique Villanueva. Has Joe mentioned him?
No.
Okay, Enrique Villanueva would be another person who I would...
Oh, yeah, I know who he is, yeah. Enrique, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Enrique, yes.
Yeah, I know him. I did one interview with him. And what about right. him? Like, have you had dealings with him?
I trust him.
Yeah.
I trust him.
Yeah, he does make a very good point. He talks about the filters, this idea that, you know, people are putting stuff through filters and people sort of get carried away with, you know, one idea and they sort of get vetted to that idea and then they sort of get off track. Yeah, he's a very sharp guy. I like him.
Right. Yes. He has a deep esoteric knowledge, which I do too, by the way. I spent all those years in there reading.
Yeah.
And that's how I acquired, I used to be a meditator. That's how I acquired, you know, I was deeply involved with ARE, Edgar Cayce.
Oh, yeah, so was I, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, I've pretty much gotten into many different things, and so... But then again, you know, like one time my daughter was in France and I was on the sofa watching television and she said to me, Dad, I'm arriving on this flight at such and such time. And I got up, woke up and boom, you know, because, as you know, we travel standby.
Yeah.
And so a lot of times we don't know. You know, I go to Europe a lot.
Yeah.
And which flight is going to be on? Wherever the seats are.
Yeah.
That's where I go. And I try to get the seats that are available that are either business or first class, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's the same to United.
Yeah.
And so that's what dictates the time and the flight number.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And so I'm retired now. Fortunately, United declared bankruptcy and they hit my retirement benefits. Yeah, I have travel benefits and I still fly part time and I fly for the sheriff but I'm 73 now, so I'm going to slowly have to shift out of here. I'm thinking of relocating to Spain.
Wow.
Because it's less expensive.
Wow.
California is way too expensive.
Yeah. It's,
I don't know anything else but aviation, so.
Wow.
You know, yeah, I'm limited there.
Fascinating story.
Yeah.
Okay, I appreciate.
If you have any questions or anything else comes up, give me a call.
I will do that. I really appreciate your telling me that, and I probably will think up something else to, because these are my two most fascinating areas. I've done a lot of research on a lot of stuff, but these two things, the flying of the craft and this whole interdimensional portal thing, just I'm just fascinated with it. And to have you, that you had an experience in both was, I talked to Joe numerous times and then I met him. We were in, I guess it was San Francisco. And that's when I said to him, I said, is this Joe guy still around? I said, cause I'd heard your story so many times. I figured I've got to talk to you. So
yeah,
I really appreciate it.
Yeah. I had to lead a double life.
Yeah.
Because I was an airline pilot.
Sure. Oh yeah.
And all of those things, like 48 hours and all that, when they would film us, I would always look away or turn around or hide my face or duck to pick up something I dropped. I was leading a double life because back then it was not convenient to attract.
That's right. Yeah.
You know.
Especially in those days, in the early days, yeah.
Yes. Now it's no big deal, you know. Now it's different. And now I have nothing to lose, basically.
Yeah.
So
okay.
Now I can. Yeah.
Beautiful.
All right, sir.
Thanks. I appreciate it. 100%. Thank you.
Okay.
And I'll be in touch some other time.
I do
Thank
have
you.
A question
yes.
for you before you leave.
Go ahead.
It's
yeah.
short.
Yeah.
And you have had yourself, because I read one of your books. And you have had yourself a very interesting experience in this lifetime. how is that going along? Is that still taking place? Is that receding at this time? What kind of a situation are you in right now, respect of that?
You mean in terms of my initial sighting? Or
yeah, all of your contacts and exposure to this field for yourself.
Well, basically, I sort of let I had these sightings in the mid 1970s, and I was into Edgar Casey like you. I really didn't have any interest in extraterrestrials. I hadn't really thought about it or anything. Yeah. I had the experience. I was sort of taken by it. And wrote a manuscript in the 1970s. Nobody would publish it, of all these sightings that this small town had seen. And it was at that point that all I was interested in was somebody had to know what I'd seen. That's why I chased the President of the United States, high-level CIA people. I figured somebody had to know what was going on. And it was everything. So a series of events happened where I didn't really plan it. I didn't plan to have the UFO sighting. And then in 2012, I have, if you've ever read, I had this download experience where I'm sitting in a lecture given by Colin Andrews, the crop circle guy, and basically yeah. I'm sort of scrambling to find out who has the answer and this sort of stuff, and it just came into my head with absolute certainty. I don't know if you've had this, where you get a message where you don't have to check it, you don't have to verify it, this is how it works, and it comes with absolute certainty, and it basically said, it's all non-local consciousness. This is the answer to this whole thing.
Right.
And it was the Canadian government. In fact, these three items popped in my head, and one of them was a document that the Canadian government had produced in 1950 that already then they had been told by Americans that mental phenomena might be associated with the flying saucers. So that's before anybody ever talked to an alien or claimed there to be, you know, contactees. There was no contactees in 1950. There's nothing. And so that's where it sort of changed for me, and that's when I went on to the connection to consciousness and all that it entails. And I sort of gave up on the sightings, I gave up on all that kind of stuff, and I became interested in experiencers or people that say have been in had Xendra experiences or the contactees, and this whole idea of antennas. If you are familiar with this Tom DeLong situation that's going on now. They have a group that's Dr. Kent Green, former CIA, Gary Nolan at Stanford University, and Hal Puthoff, and they're working with experiencers. And it was, as I have got a couple of friends who are involved in this program, and they're very sort of closed mouth about what they're doing. They've told me a little bit about it, but they're trying to get a peer-reviewed paper published. So that's the thing. They don't want to blow the peer-reviewed paper. It's going to be very skeptical, people are trying to present to. And they're dealing with experiencers, and that's what I've said since 2012, that if you want to understand the UFO phenomena and what is actually going, you've got to talk to the people like you, who have interacted with the intelligence behind the phenomena. It doesn't matter if you see all the stuff in the sky you want. None of that matters. And so they're working with experiencers, and it was that used the word antenna. What they say is that every experiencer and every highly psychic person like Uri Geller, Ingo Swann, they have all those people's DNA, have a DNA marker. They all have a DNA marker, and they have a brain pattern that they are calling the antenna. And when they said that, I was just floored. I asked one of the guys I knew was in the program. I said, Chris, they tested you in this program. Did they use the word antenna? And he said, yeah, they used the word. And so it's the same concept. And so this guy, when I was talking about the consciousness and the whole the Xendra thing and all that, I gave a lecture in L.A.
Right.
And the guy from Stanford saw the lecture, and he put out, I don't know where he posted it, but he said, when it comes to ETs and UFOs, Grant Cameron is dead on. And I think that's what he's referring to, is this whole idea that people are able to dissociate, that if you can tap in, whether it's through a mantra, through a head injury, through whatever method you use, meditation, you know, hypnosis, whatever, if you're able to tap in, the consciousness is there. These beings are there for everybody. And it's the ability to tap in. There's nothing random about it. So it's that's where I've gone. And so almost every lecture I give now, I'll say, okay, you can talk about, you want disclosure, whatever. But in the end, it's this consciousness. It's the experiencer people. These are the people you got to listen to. And they will tell you what's going on. They're getting messages, and I don't care if you put them under lie detectors or whatever you want to do. But these are the people who have the answer if there's ever going to be an answer. And so that's why I really like listen to people like you and Joe Burks, who's had a number of contacts. And he has, this, I think he calls it programmed telepathy or something. So it's the same concept. Everybody's using that same concept, that there are techniques where you can tap into this thing. And some people have learned to do it. And I think we got to start listening to those people.
Yeah, that's what prompted me to go to Monroe's Institute.
Oh, you've been there.
Applied
Good.
Sciences.
Good, yeah, wonderful.
Yes, I met Joe McGonigal. We spent the whole afternoon.
Wow.
I went through the Gateway program. I tried to see if there was a way to consciously throw the switch.
Yeah.
Because I have had these downloads, and sure, one time it happened. I was flying as a passenger from Denver back to L.A. after I had been through the simulator, and I had a glass of wine.
Yeah.
And, oh, man, it was a torrent of information. And it came so fast.
Fascinating.
And it's like you're on a high.
Yeah.
And it's all so clear.
Yeah.
It's just so simple, so apparent, so direct.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like, wow.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
And once it could, then it shuts down, and that's it.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
over.
That's right.
And so, anyways. Thank
yeah.
you so much.
Sure.
It's been very, very nice. Thanks for,
okay.
Bringing me up to speed on what's going on at your end.
Okay, good. And I'll maybe maybe I'll even send you a manuscript. I don't know if you read my book Inspired. You might be interested in that, because when I had my download experience, that's when I started looking at downloads. And then I suddenly realized that Paul McCartney got this song Yesterday in a Dream, and that, the theory of relativity came in a dream, and the scientific method came in a dream. I wrote a whole book on called Inspired, The Paranormal World of Creativity, where I look at Nobel Prizes, I look at musicians, artists, people who wrote books, and it's the same thing. Everybody's had these sort of download experiences, and to me that's the most fascinating thing, is that you can tap into this. It's just developing a method to do it, and the experiences of the people who have learned in some way to do it, and that's why I say they're the most important people in the world, and they're being ignored in the UFO community. People want to have, we want to measure, we want to be able to see it, and all this kind of stuff.
Right.
And no.
They want the Hollywoods,
They
want the show.
Yeah, but it's people like you that I appreciate. So thank you, Joe, and we'll talk again.
All right, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You bet.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Have a good day.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
That's this week's episode of the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. I'm your host, Grant Cameron, hoping that you will join me for upcoming episodes. Links to my YouTube interviews, books, and my Facebook sites are in the show notes. If you love the podcast or learn something valuable, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on today's episode. If you would like a certain paranormal subject dealt with in the future, please let us know. Until next time, watch this space, and thank you so much for listening.
T-minus 25 seconds. 20 seconds and counting. T-minus 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, all engine running. Liftoff, we have a liftoff, 32 minutes past the hour. Tower cleared.
We got a roll program.
And as Apollo 11 does its roll program, this podcast now does its roll program. The tape is rolling. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. My name is Grant Cameron, and you're listening to the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. Thank you for taking time from your life to be here. This is Podcast 1, Act 1, Scene 1. This is the first podcast. This is just an introductory podcast, which just explains why I'm doing this. It should be shorter and just spell things out. My name is Grant Cameron, and the reason I had decided to do a podcast was not because I want to do a podcast. I really don't enjoy interviewing people or doing this kind of stuff. I'm basically sort of a historian in terms of gathering the material. So the podcast is going to be on the paranormal, which is a big part of my studies today. UFOs, which is where I started. Consciousness is where I ended up. And the podcast idea is centered around the idea that a lot of people don't do YouTube. I was talked into doing YouTube. I'd done 400 plus interviews of shows on YouTube. And I've also done a lot of interviews that are on other people's YouTube channels. And what I find is that when I look at YouTube, I really, a lot of times, don't watch the whole YouTube video. I'll watch for 15 minutes and then I've got something else to do. I do listen to podcasts, though. And what I've been told, or I've heard figures of 90 million people listen to podcasts. And so I decided what I would do is I would basically transfer over all my YouTube material onto a podcast form. Because most of the material that I do on YouTube is done with Zoom. And Zoom actually provides you with a video copy and an audio copy of the interview. So I have all these huge audio files. And what I find is when you look at the data on the YouTube channel, on your own YouTube, what you find out is that a lot of people aren't really watching the YouTube all the way through. And so people may watch, say, for 20 minutes, first commercial comes up or whatever, and they turn it off and go do something else. So a lot of that material is sort of being wasted. Whereas with a podcast, a lot of people will do podcasts the same as me, that you have it in the car, you can just keep going, or you go, you're walking or whatever, and you just listen to the whole podcast and you get all the material. The problem with the YouTube thing is that sometimes the best stories are told near the end of the interview. So people will miss the best stories. So I'm doing two things. I'm doing the podcast, which will have the entire YouTube audio. And I will do some sessions that are just audio, just podcast interviews. But in that, you have all the stories that you can hear however you listen to your podcasts. And I've noticed that it will probably get a lot more people who will hear the story. So I'm doing two things. I'm doing the podcast. I'm also doing what are called stoplight videos, where I'm going to take the best stories out of the YouTube videos, interviews I did, and put them into little short clips of a couple of minutes, so that if the good story is told at the end of the podcast, or the end of the YouTube video, a lot of people will not have heard it. Even with podcasts, at the end of the podcast, a lot of people, if it's a good story, they won't have heard it. So I'm going to take these very good stories out of the interviews and put them on what are called stoplight videos. But I've noticed in my experience driving on bus, going to do my volunteer stuff, that what you see on the bus is that most people are on a cell phone. Almost everybody on the bus is on a cell phone. And they're flip, 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 flip. And you can see they're going through Facebook. And they're just flipping through. So the modern world, as much as we may disagree with what's going on, is a world where people have very short attention spans. And if you want to get your message across, you need to get it in a way that people are using during their daily life. You have to accommodate to what people are doing. So I'm documenting all my interviews that I've done. The same way that I've also documented a lot of files. I have all the files from all the various presidential libraries, which is thousands of pages of documents. I intend to put those up on a OneDrive thing where people can access them. I have started to collect all the Stanton Friedman files. I have the first 6,000 pages of a collection that may be hundreds, well, maybe millions of pages of material. And that's what the podcast is about. So if anybody's got any advice, any suggestions of things they want done, things to make it better, let me know. Let me conclude by saying that I believe that the paranormal world of UFOs, consciousness, is the Super Bowl of all stories. If you understand what's going on, this is an extremely important story. And the podcast is simply another way to record that story, my experience in that story, and what I've learned. So hopefully you'll listen. Thanks for taking time to listen to episode one. That's this week's episode of the Paranormal UFO Consciousness Podcast. I'm your host, Grant Cameron, hoping that you will join me for upcoming episodes. Links to my YouTube interviews, books, and my Facebook sites are in the show notes. If you love the podcast or learn something valuable, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, or give a review on today's episode. If you would like a certain paranormal subject dealt with in the future, please let us know. Until next time, watch this space, and thank you so much for listening.